Good morning and welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad that you're listening. History has tended to be quite harsh in its judgment of Lyndon Johnson. I think many people consider him to be a tragic figure and his presidency to be in many ways a lost opportunity. And certainly Vietnam cast a very long shadow over Johnson and tends to overshadow many of his achievements. Our guest here this morning, however, historian Randall Woods, takes a somewhat different view. He believes that Lyndon Johnson was a flawed but also a deeply sympathetic character. He says that he believes that LBJ was driven to politics by his belief in the tradition of public service. He says that he was a cold warrior for the same reason that he was a champion of civil rights, because he believed that both causes were America's God-given duty. This morning, in this first hour of the show, we will talk with Randall Woods about his newly published biography, LBJ, Architect of American Ambition. It's published by the Free Press. Randall Woods is John A. Cooper Distinguished Professor of History at the University of Arkansas, where he has taught since 1971. He's joining us this morning by phone. And as we talk, as always, questions are welcome. The only thing we ask of callers is people are brief so that we can keep moving along, get in as many people as possible. But certainly your questions are welcome. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 is the number to call. We do also have a toll-free line. That means if it would be a long-distance call for you, use that number. That's 800-222-9455. At any point, your questions are welcome. Professor Woods, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks for talking with us.
Well, thanks for having me.
Certainly, I believe, and I think that people believe, that historians are always in the process of refining and adding to our knowledge of the past. Having said that, when you look at a figure like Lyndon Johnson, about whom a lot has been written, I think one has to ask, are there really things at this point that have yet to be said about Lyndon Johnson? Is there still more to know about Lyndon Johnson?
Well, I certainly think so. That's a self-interested answer, but my biography is the first biography written since the publication of the White House telephone conversations, mm-hmm. and some 10,000 hours. Those tapes are a biographer's dream because they not only reveal new information about the decisions that President Johnson made, they show his mood, his temper, his relationship with other people. Moreover, I was able to conduct several exclusive interviews with people who were close to him, who had not given interviews, and I was able to get several thousand national security documents declassified.
It certainly seems that this man was a remarkable collection of contrasts, that he had the reputation of being rough and crude, and at the same time, he was obviously very sophisticated. He was very good at dealing with his political peers. Some people think that he was the greatest majority leader ever in the Senate. And at the same time, he was pretty bad at dealing with the press. An amazing sort of a combination of conflicting qualities in the same person.
It's well said. I think you summed up the contradictions. He was a driven man, probably borderline manic depressive. That's according to the family physician. He was given to wide mood swings. His part of that stemmed from the conflict between his mother and father, who had very different lifestyles. His mother was a Southern Baptist. His father was a Christadelphian and a kind of rounder. He episodic alcoholic, and there was that tension that he experienced in the family. Well, the one thing that his parents did agree on was they were both committed to the social gospel, and they were both committed to public service, and they transferred all of their ambitions, which were considerable, to Lyndon Johnson. So he was very much a driven person, but he could be very petty in dealing with small matters. He tended to be much wiser and cooler when in major crises. But you're quite right. He could be sophisticated and crude, he was terrible at handling the press, almost perverse. He didn't acknowledge that there were disinterested journalists who were trying to look at things rationally. He believed that everybody was acting from self-interest. When he was caricatured in the press, his reaction was to act out those caricatures in a kind of passive aggression, passive-aggressive fashion.
Hmm. Well, that's interesting that you should say that he believed that everybody was acting out of self-interest. For someone like him, though, who seemed genuinely to be motivated from a young age by this notion of public service, did he think he was the only guy in the world who wasn't motivated by self-interest?
I think that he believed that everybody had the capacity to act for the greater good, and it was his mission in life to appeal to that greater good. That his distrust of the press didn't extend to other people, to the general public, just to the press. It was a uniquely kind of twisted attitude.
Yeah. Certainly, previous writers have talked about the importance of his parents as an influence on him in the way he thought about the world, the way he thought about what government service was all about, that particular emphasis has been put on his father, who was involved in politics. Mm-hmm. He was in the Texas legislature. He was very close to Sam Rayburn, who was the Speaker of the House. Mm-hmm. But I think that one thing that you have done that perhaps have stressed more perhaps than previous writers is the significance of his mother, Rebecca Baines, to mm-hmm. the person that he would become. Mm-hmm. Perhaps you can talk about both of them, but certainly about his mother.
Yeah, she was a very ambitious woman. She was very close to her father, who was a successful lawyer and businessman, a devout Baptist. But she and her father were not the kind of anti-evolution fundamentalists that many people associate with the Southern Baptist tradition in the 1920s. She and her father were liberal Baptists. They believed in the social gospel. They believed in public service. She was very well read. Browning, Tennyson. She liked music. She was determined to try to bring culture to her family and to Johnson City, the German-dominated community in which they lived in the Hill Country. But she was a very hard woman too. The love she extended to her children was conditional love. It came if they behaved in ways that she expected them to. And her ambition for Johnson really knew no limits. In fact, while she praised him, there was always a kernel of criticism. There was always this kind of psychological spur that she put to him.
It seems that he was someone who, from a relatively young age, was interested in doing something to help people who were disadvantaged. And I'm very interested in this story, for example. When he was in college, he went to a teacher's college, and he took a year off, and he taught school in a school where most of the students were poor Mexican-American kids. And he apparently was a good teacher. I think they would have liked to have him continue as a teacher there. He apparently was a good teacher and was very sympathetic to the conditions and the potential, the difficulties that these children faced.
I think his experience as a college student temporarily teaching in Cotulla was crucial in forming his character, and also it's illustrative of his personality. Mexican Americans in South Texas were treated like African Americans in an inner city ghetto in the 1920s and 1930s. He taught at the Wellhausen School, which was an all Hispanic school. The school system was strictly segregated. These children were not expected to go any further in life. The dominant Anglo-Saxon culture expected them to be laborers in the vineyard and nothing else. And Johnson challenged the dominant power structure there by telling these children that they had every right to go to college, to be president of the United States. He developed extracurricular activities for them. There were a number of liberal members of the community that he established contact with, and really, was responsible for a fundamental change in that community. But again, I think you see a sympathy for the disadvantaged and for minorities at an early age. Mm.
Our guest is Randall Woods. He's professor of history at the University of Arkansas. He's the author of a newly published biography of Johnson, Lyndon Johnson. The title of the book is LBJ, Architect of American Ambition, and it's published by the Free Press. Just came out officially at the beginning of August, so certainly you can find it in the bookstore if you'd like to read the book. Questions, comments on this program always are welcome to 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. After he graduated from college, he made the most of the kind of connections that his family had, and he went to Washington and got work as a legislative aide and was able to really learn politics by watching and by talking to people and even at that point making connections. So it was that was his education, his first education in politics. At what point did he think, do you think he made this conscious decision, though, that was somehow his life would involve being in government?
Well, I think as a college student, he had an instructor at Southwest Texas State who was taught him political science and history, who he was very close to, and I think that individual instilled in him the notion that politics was a place where a person could make his mark, and it would satisfy this need in him to perform public service. But of course, his father had been in politics, and he had a number of relatives on his mother's side who were active in politics. One of them was a former governor of Kentucky, if I recall correctly. But it materialized specifically when he was in Houston. After he graduated, he took a job teaching in the Houston school district there. And when this the opportunity to go to Washington as a legislative aide to Richard Kleeberg came up, he leapt at it.
Yeah, he made the most of these kinds of connections that he had to people who were important in Texas politics, and then thereby in national politics. And one, perhaps one of the most important, as I mentioned, was a member of Congress from Texas, Sam Rayburn, who was the Speaker of the House. How important for Johnson was that relationship?
Oh, I think it was very important. Johnson was as a young man was very adept at becoming a protege to more powerful people, Sam Rayburn being one of them, Richard Russell being another. He would flatter them, he would pay attention to them socially, but he would also exploit them, and although they knew he was exploiting them and their connections, he used the more powerful people that he came in contact with as a means of ascent.
Yeah, I think that it was at this time also, during the time that he had this work in Washington, that he met the woman that would become his wife and that we would come to know as Lady Bird.
That's right. He met her because he had a date with one of her friends. He asked her to breakfast the next morning. She was repelled and attracted by him and nearly didn't show up for the appointment, but she did. They spent the entire day together. At the end of the day, he proposed to her, which, of course, appalled her. But she found him interesting and compelling enough not to pull away completely. And their courtship was brief but intense.
Mm-hmm. Just the other day, I had the opportunity to talk with someone who has written now, fairly recently, has written a biography of Dolly Madison.
Uh-huh.
And about her, how she helped to create the job of First Lady, and
uh-huh.
about how she was very much involved in Washington politics and in creating spaces for people to come together to do what today we would call networking, and that what an influential figure that she was in her time. And it makes you think about just how important the partners of the men who become president are. and about how much and in how many different ways they contribute to the success of their husbands, perhaps some more than others. Maybe you could talk a little bit about Lady Bird and about how the fact that she stuck with him for good and bad through no doubt a number of marital infidelities and a lot of difficult times, and how it was that she contributed to whatever success we would say that he had.
Well, I think she was crucial. She didn't take a direct role in public affairs except for the beautification effort, which was significant, certainly. But she wasn't as active as, say, Eleanor Roosevelt. But she was crucial to Lyndon Johnson's success because she was crucial to his personal well-being. She was very stoic. She was a calming influence. She was one of the few people that whose advice Johnson took unquestioningly, and he consulted her on most major topics, certainly having to do with his person and his political career. He loved her. He found her disappointing at times. She was a very practical person, an attractive woman, but not romantic. Her daughters, for example, said they never saw her cry, and she had a fairly harsh upbringing, and her mother died at an early age, and there was that stoicism, but. They were a pair, and Johnson would not have been at all the person that he was without her. For her, she knew about the infidelities. I think they tormented her more than she let on, but she tolerated them. As she said, Lyndon Johnson provided her an opportunity to live a life and to meet people and to become involved in things that she never, ever dreamed that she would that would happen.
It seems that with figures like Johnson and other political figures, that's something that in a sense, in some sort of perverse way, fascinates us. And I'm sure that there were probably many politicians who were married and who didn't cheat on their wives. But why is it that you think that we seem to want to make so much of something like that, or do you in fact think that we make too much of that?
I think we make too much of it. I think. But I think there's a distinction here, if you will. I think that Jack Kennedy, for example, a very admirable person in many respects, but in his attitude, he would be called a womanizer, a man who had serial affairs, who really didn't have much feeling for the people he was involved with. Johnson did that occasionally, but he loved being in love. He had long-term affairs with Alice Glass and Helen Douglas, and they were smart, attractive women. And I think that his craving for that, his need to have a love interest aside from Lady Bird, is a commentary on his character, and is worthy of talking about.
Mm-hmm. You know, I wonder with somebody like this, someone who comes from humble origins, relatively humble origins, someone who early on has this strong desire to do public service, to get in, and has natural sort of connections to politics. So it doesn't surprise you that someone like that would run for office. And he was elected to the Congress. He later was elected to the Senate, became a vice president. And then when John Kennedy was assassinated, he became president. Wonder, with someone like that, at what point in their life do you think they actually might and even entertain the possibility, might even allow themselves to think about the possibility that they could one day be the president of the United States? When does one even start, you know, that see that as even a tiny distant glimmer that you would think to yourself, well, maybe one day I actually could be president?
I think he had... there were people who talked to him about being president. Johnson When Johnson went to Congress as a congressman after he was elected in 1937, he associated himself with Franklin Roosevelt and all of the New Dealers. And he was friends with Abe Fortas and Tommy Corcoran and James Rowe. These were people around Roosevelt, the architects of the New Deal. And he was a thoroughgoing New Dealer himself. After Roosevelt's death, I think that Johnson was one of the people that they looked to be Roosevelt's heir, to carry on his tradition. They considered William O. Douglas, but he was for a while, but he was too bizarre. And Johnson had all the tools. His problem was that he was from Texas, dominated by oil and gas interests, associated with it was an ex-Confederate state, associated with Jim Crow. But still, he was getting information throughout the 1950s that he, under the right circumstances, could be president and could carry on the New Deal tradition. I think once he became a Senate Majority Leader and began to get a lot of national attention, that that germ of ambition began to grow even larger. But Johnson was an ambitious man, but he was also quite insecure. Frequently, he would get up to the edge of the water, and to use an analogy, and then step back. When he ran for the presidency in 1960, he really didn't run. He didn't run in any of the primaries. His lieutenants were furious with him for being so ambivalent. On the eve of the 1964 Democratic National Convention in Atlantic City, he actually drafted a withdrawal statement and was barely persuaded from delivering it. So I don't, you know, and when he became president accidentally after the assassination, his political future looked extremely bleak. The Kennedys put him on the ticket merely to carry Texas. Rumors were that they were going to drop him from the ticket. So, ironically, on the eve of his accession to the presidency, he believed that his career was at an end.
Yeah, apparently, the story is that they didn't particularly like him. They didn't have a lot of respect for him. They, again, as you say, they put him on the ticket so he could bring them Texas, and that after they won, they wouldn't give him anything to do.
That's correct.
Nothing really of nothing of importance.
No, nothing of importance. The attitudes within the Kennedy White House toward Johnson ranged from mild contempt to real dislike. Bobby Kennedy particularly disliked Johnson, and their rivalry would play a major role in Johnson's presidency, but. He was limited to overseeing the space program and to running the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, and given a few foreign assignments. But really, what bothered him was, aside from the contempt, was that the New Frontier, the Kennedys' domestic program, was stalled in Congress, and there the Kennedys had access to one of the greatest congressional politicians of all time, that is LBJ, and didn't use him.
He, as you say, he ran for the House in 1937. Then in 1941, he ran for the Senate unsuccessfully against the man who was at that time the governor of Texas.
Right.
He served in the war, not in combat, but he did serve in the war, which is something he said that he would do if war. He apparently, when he was campaigning for the Senate, he said, "Look, if the war breaks out, I'm going to go in and serve in the military," which he did.
Mm-hmm.
And then he came back and in 1948 ran again for the Senate. This time he won. In both of his runs for the Senate in 41 and 48, there were charges all over on both sides of election fraud.
That's right.
And questions about just, in fact, what had happened here. Is there something that you can say definitively about, particularly in 48 when he actually won, about whether there were serious issues about how this took place?
Sure. In both 41 and 48, there was voting fraud. His Pappy Leo Daniel and his lieutenants really took the election away from Johnson and John Conley, his lieutenant, because they were too inexperienced. In 48, there were charges of fraud on both sides. But the consensus among historians now who have studied that is that if all the votes were counted fairly in 48, Johnson would have won by about 5,000 votes. The Johnson people in 48, because of the legal strategy they took, couldn't charge Coke Stevenson with fraud, because the approach they took was to argue that the federal courts had no jurisdiction over a state election. Their strategy was not to say, you know, you committed greater fraud than we did, and so their hands that legal strategy turned out to be successful. But then the impression is left with Johnson defrauded Stevenson from the election. But in a fair count, I think he would have won by probably 5,000 votes.
We have a caller here to bring into the conversation. Let's do that on our line one in Champaign. Hello.
Good morning. You were recently talking about LBJ being picked to run with Kennedy as his vice president. It's always puzzled me who was really behind that to convince the Kennedy, because you just said, which I remember from those days, that Bobby really disliked LBJ. Whom do you think was instrumental in convincing them? And also, you might address his hanging on to the Vietnam War so long. Thank you.
All right. Well, thanks for the calls. The questions?
Sure. I think Jack Kennedy was responsible. Kennedy was an excellent politician. He knew the election was going to be very close. He was Catholic. Johnson was a Protestant. Johnson was from the South and the West. He was from the Northeast. And according to their calculations, they would have to have Texas and its electoral votes to win. Bobby and his, particularly his liberal supporters, were appalled by Johnson's selection. Johnson's progressive views on civil rights had not yet become apparent, and African Americans didn't trust him. They would by the time he was through being vice president because of his work on the EEOC. But Jack Kennedy had to put down a rebellion within his own party. But it was his decision to pick Johnson, and it was a smart political decision. The Vietnam issue is a huge issue. Johnson supported the U.S. involvement in Vietnam while he was vice president, but he was adamantly opposed to the coup which ousted Ngo Dinh Diem. He believed that was a major mistake. He believed that it would lead to political chaos in South Vietnam, which was quite true. But he became president. He was an accidental president. He wasn't elected in his own right. And his position was that the Kennedy administration had made a commitment to support a non-communist regime in the South, and that it was his duty to carry on that obligation, to fulfill that obligation. He hoped that he would not have to escalate the war, but because of the political chaos that followed in the wake of Diem's death, the situation grew so dire there that he decided, after it took him 8 months to decide after the Gulf of Tonkin, but he after much agonizing, decided that he had to put U.S. troops into Vietnam. He was always unsure about whether that was the right thing to do or not. But what you must remember is that throughout this period, public opinion polls, this is through 1968, public opinion polls showed that a clear majority of Americans believed that the United States ought to make a stand in Southeast Asia somewhere against the forces of Sino-Soviet imperialism, particularly the Chinese communists. Now, people became dissatisfied with the war in Vietnam because of the way it was being fought, and because we were not winning, but that there was a clear consensus that we had to make a stand in Southeast Asia, and Johnson paid attention to those polls.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, Randall Woods. He's John A. Cooper, Distinguished Professor of History at the University of Arkansas. He's taught there since 1971. He is the author of a newly published biography of Lyndon Johnson. The title of the book is LBJ, Architect of American Ambition. It's published by the Free Press. Just has been out officially here a couple of weeks. I'm sure you can find it in the bookstore. Questions also here on the program are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. He was, as we mentioned, he was elected to the Senate. He was chosen to be the minority leader, and apparently, I believe he was the youngest person ever to be minority leader in the Senate. Mm-hmm. And then the next year, when the Democrats got the majority in the Senate, he became the majority leader, and he was very, very good at getting things done in the Congress. And then also, when he went on to become the president, I think that he was his skill at being able to move things through Congress enabled him perhaps to be more effective than he might have been otherwise. What was it about him that made him so good in that atmosphere, so good at moving the things along that he wanted to move along?
He was probably the greatest collector of information, and he almost had a sixth sense about anticipating how people would vote, how things would play out. When he was a superb majority leader, but remember, he didn't, because the Republicans controlled the White House, because the very popular Dwight Eisenhower was president, Johnson, as majority leader, could only aid or block the Eisenhower administration's agenda. And he was very successful in that. It wasn't until he was president that he was really able to demonstrate his genius as a legislative politician. One of the reasons he installed a taping system in the White House was to keep track of the conversations, the thousands of conversations he had with congressmen and senators, journalists. He would put together coalitions, voting coalitions. For example, he would persuade northern senators and representatives to vote for subsidies to the wheat bill, and in turn get southerners to vote for urban transit. He's famous for the so-called Johnson treatment, these personal, intense conversations he had with senators and congressmen. His critics argued that he was intimidating them, that he was using personal information against them. That simply wasn't the case, as the White House tapes show. What Johnson would do would be to tell them, I know that there are certain issues that you cannot vote for or against because of the nature of your constituents. But on this issue, this doesn't affect your constituency, so you can vote the national interest. He would appeal repeatedly to people's patriotism, as corny as that sounds. But as many a congressman and senator said, I felt like when I got through talking with Johnson that if I didn't do what he wanted to do, I was being un-American.
You talked a little bit earlier about how it was that he felt when he became president after Kennedy was assassinated.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you could talk a little bit more about that, what he said, what his feelings were at the time, and what he felt about coming to the presidency in that way.
He was very much aware that he was an accidental president. He was he did not have the advantage, as all duly elected presidents have, of having the period between the election and the inauguration to select cabinet members, to develop a program. He had to go just from that moment. In foreign policy, he felt it necessary to keep on Kennedy's advisors. He supported the New Frontier, but he believed that it was much too modest. And in his early days as president, he quickly began to flesh out the nearly 1,000 pieces of legislation that collectively became the Great Society. His desire was to fulfill the promise of the New Deal, Fair Deal, New Frontier. As far as foreign policy was concerned, particularly Vietnam, he hoped to just manage those crises so that they would not undermine what he was trying to do at home in the area of civil rights, anti-poverty legislation, immigration reform, clean air, clean water.
he accomplished a thing to give him his due. He accomplished a good deal, and he accomplished a good deal quickly, and perhaps in part because he realized he might not have that much time.
That's right.
That presidents don't the honeymoon is brief, and your opportunity really, when you have the support of everybody, is pretty short, not a big window. So he knew, and he understood that. What would you say? Let's simply talk on the domestic side of things. Would have been his most important contributions, and there, because they were a number, that may be a difficult thing to just single out one or two things.
Well, I think you have to begin with the Civil Rights Acts of 1964, the Equal Accommodations Law, the Voting Rights Act of 1965. And one that many people overlook, the Fair Housing Act of 1968, amazing achievement, given that it was passed in 68 in the midst of urban rioting, white backlash, discontent over Vietnam. Certainly, I think that's what any historian evaluating his domestic agenda would begin with. But one of the things that people have overlooked is the Immigration Act of 1965, which really ensured that this country remained a country of diversity. Between the 1920s and 1965, the number of foreign-born people in this country had decreased dramatically and would continue to decrease. And the Immigration Act of 1965 opened the doors again. I think another thing that people overlook is public radio and public television, and the National Endowment for the Arts, the National Endowment for the Humanities, the beginnings of environmental legislation, clean air, clean water. But the anti-poverty program, Medicare. Medicaid. People are very critical of Medicare, particularly because of its budgetary implications. But I dare say there are not many Americans who would be willing to say that they would like to go back to the time when there was no Medicare.
Yeah, I think definitely here, we, those of us who work in public broadcasting, have to give him the nod, because he was very much instrumental in setting up the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, which is the big federal funding agency that gives money to public radio and television. So I think really that's, and it's about that time that we see the origins of National Public Radio.
Right.
Well, our guest in this part of Focus 580, Randall Woods, he's professor of history at University of Arkansas. We have about 15 minutes left in this part of the show. We're talking about Lyndon Johnson. He has authored a new biography that's titled LBJ, Architect of American Ambition, published by Free Press. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. You know, given the fact that he did come to the presidency by fate when Kennedy was assassinated, and that he felt at that time not particularly optimistic about the situation that he had inherited. Was it surprising to him? Was it surprising to other people that when he then was elected in his own right, that he was so successful? He won by the widest popular margin in American history when he was actually elected as president of the United States.
I think people were surprised at that. Some would say something that he resented, I think, but some would say that he was fortunate in having had Barry Goldwater as an opponent. Goldwater was perceived at the time by both Republicans and Democrats as an extremist. Indeed, Johnson got almost as many Republican votes as Goldwater did. And Goldwater got a lot of Southern Democratic votes, segregationist votes. So there was that. Maybe Johnson would have not fared as well against a more conventional candidate, Richard Nixon or George Romney. But I think not. Johnson was able to benefit from his association with Jack Kennedy. He used Kennedy's martyrdom to push through his domestic program, but also to advance his own political fortunes. There's no question about that. But Johnson gave out this aura of competence, and even in foreign policy, he seemed to be, he wasn't an ideologue. He'd been a great opponent of Joe McCarthy. He seemed a kind of reasonable cold warrior. which I think he was, there was his idealism, Kennedy's death certainly gave a Kennedy's martyrdom and the civil rights movement and the moral rhetoric that Martin Luther King used created a kind of liberal impulse in 1964, 1965 that helped Johnson very much.
Mm-hmm. His strong commitment to civil rights, certainly something that was there in the Kennedy administration, but even more so when he became president. We certainly have to see that as one of the forces, maybe the primary force that helped to weaken the Democratic Party in the South, turn Democrats into Republicans. Now, that was something certainly the Nixon administration really they worked on very heavily, the so-called Southern strategy.
Mm-hmm.
Did Johnson think about that, or what did he think about what did he see that the weakening of Democratic power in the South as a result of this push for civil rights?
Absolutely. In one of the conversations, I can't recall with whom, perhaps John Connally, in the midst of the filibuster over the 1964 Civil Rights Act, Johnson said, you know, this is going to deliver the South to the Republican Party. But he said, I don't see any other alternative. If the Democratic Party does not come out forthrightly in behalf of civil rights, it's going to be relegated to backwater anyway. It's going to become the minority party anyway. And so he believed that that the cause was greater than any partisan consideration.
Let's talk with another caller, someone in Urbana, line one. Hello?
Hello.
Yes.
You haven't mentioned specifically the thing that I remember President Johnson for, because it had a tremendous impact on my personal life, was the scholarships and the interest in special education. I graduated from college in 1965 and decided I wanted to be a teacher of the deaf, and I was able to get a scholarship from the government to go into special education, and I'm celebrating my 40th year of working with the deaf.
Well, congratulations. And I should have mentioned it, too, because I benefited immensely from it as well, because I went into teaching under legislation that was passed during this administration. Half of my student loans were forgiven.
Yes. I think it was 15% for each year I taught.
Exactly. I should have mentioned that. The Higher Education Act, federal aid to education, was probably, next to civil rights, would be the achievement that he would be most proud of.
Well, it certainly made a difference in my life.
Good.
And many others.
Yes, indeed.
Thank you very much.
Well, thank you for the call. Others are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Perhaps we could talk a little bit more about Vietnam, as this is the thing that in spite of everything else, I think many people would say this was what defined his presidency. That's the thing that if people say ultimately it was a tragedy and a failure, that's the thing that they're talking about. And it's odd because on the one hand he was the one who oversaw a great expansion of U.S. involvement there and of numbers of troops there, so some of this was the result of his deliberate actions. At the same time, the way he talked about Vietnam, he talked about it as if it was something that was somehow beyond his control, and it seems very odd that. On the one hand, he would be the person who was so much instrumental in U.S. involvement. And on the other hand, he would talk about how he thought it was tragic. He thought it was a mess. He thought it was a quagmire. He thought that we were bogged down there. He thought that we really weren't going to be able to win, that it was just awful, and that somehow he also felt that it was something that he was in that he couldn't pull himself out of.
That's exactly right. Johnson had a very controlling personality. one of his faults was that he believed that he could, that he was responsible for everything and everybody, that particularly in this country, that he could, through force of will and work, make things happen. That didn't happen with Vietnam. He did preside over the expansion, and he is responsible for the escalation of the war and the thousands and tens of thousands of deaths of Americans and Vietnamese. It occurred on his watch. I don't think he would have argued. He didn't argue otherwise. I think he believed that he bore responsibility for that. I think he was ambivalent about that. Perhaps his only redemption in this regard is his anguish over it and his uncertainty. He believed that that he had gotten the best he could out of the foreign policy establishment in this country. I mean, he was dealing with, to use David Halberstam's term, the best and the brightest: McGeorge Bundy, Robert McNamara, Dean Rush. These were brilliant people. As I said, he took nearly 8 months to decide to escalate the war. At the end of that time, he believed that the decision to escalate was represented the consensus of the military and the foreign policy establishment. He believed that it was temporary. Like all presidents, from Eisenhower through Nixon, the idea was not to stay in Vietnam, but to try to turn the conflict over to the South Vietnamese themselves. So even by 1967, Johnson believed that the consensus in behalf of the war was deteriorating, not only because of discontent with the war, but because of the white backlash that was sweeping the country and eroding the idealism that was at the base of both civil rights and Vietnam. And in the fall of 1967, he had plans to withdraw from Vietnam if he could be assured that the North would not overrun the South by force. He was willing to withdraw American troops, to allow communists to participate in elections in the South, to let matters take their course. But he felt that he couldn't stand by and let the North overrun the South by force, because America's credibility and the whole containment regime that had been built up since World War II would crumble.
Mm-hmm. And that is something that perhaps we don't, it's difficult to understand today, and that we don't accept anymore, that the proverbial domino theory, but that for people who were, for whom the Cold War was a very important and sort of formative experience, he did sincerely believe that that kind of containment was necessary, and that if not, communism would spread and could indeed pose a threat to the United States. That was something that he sincerely did believe.
Absolutely, absolutely. And remember, this was just 20 years after the end of the Second World War, and these people were still, for better or worse, learning the lessons of World War II. And in the book, in 1966, he had become so disgusted with the domestic situation in South Vietnam that he told Dean Rusk to consider pulling back to Thailand and abandoning South Vietnam. And Rusk came back and said, "We can't do that. Thailand is militarily just an empty shell. So is Cambodia. We have to make our stand here in South Vietnam, because Laos and the other states would be much worse place to make a stand."
How did he go about making his decision not to run for re-election in 68?
Well, he always, within his family, he had talked about not running, and the consensus was that it wouldn't be a good thing. He'd suffered a massive heart attack in 1955. The stress of being president, as it does with all individuals, takes a terrible toll. His personal physician told him that if he was elected to another term, he probably wouldn't live that term out. He repeatedly said that he did not want to be like Woodrow Wilson, who spent his last months in the White House as an invalid. But then there was Vietnam, and when William Westmoreland came home in the fall of 1967 to report on Vietnam, Johnson told him in confidence that he was not going to run. And I think that Johnson believed that he himself had become such a divisive figure that if he removed himself from public life and did not run, that that there might be a better chance for reconciliation in this country and perhaps successful peace negotiations over Vietnam.
Yeah, he died not that long after leaving the presidency, only a couple of years after. And he was not that old. He was only 64.
Mm-hmm.
Did he feel, as he was thinking about his presidency and weighing up the pluses and the minuses, did he feel that he had been a success?
I think so. I think so. I think he was anguished about Vietnam, but I think that he believed that. Well, he was anguished. He wasn't certain that he did the right thing. But his domestic achievements were tremendous. I think that he had a sense that he did the best that he could under the circumstances.
We're going to have to finish because we're coming here to the end, and obviously this is a long and complicated story, and there's a whole lot more to be said. So if you're interested in exploring the life of Lyndon Johnson, and you're looking for a good one-volume book, look for this one. It's just out now in the bookstores. The book, again, is titled LBJ, Architect of American Ambition, by our guest Randall Woods. He is John A. Cooper, Distinguished Professor of History at University of Arkansas. And Professor Woods, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.